Child and Youth Development Policy will come to order, and Representative Moran moves the minutes of March 11. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. First bill up will be, where is Representative Norton? She's hiding. Chair will move House File 2001 be re-referred to Committee on Health and Human Services Policy. Go ahead, Representative Norton, present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. This summer, a group of my area providers called a meeting, and they wanted to share some concerns about specifically about the corrective actions that have been happening locally, as well as a myriad of other issues. I met with them and asked them to talk to the department because I knew the department was also working on some language concerning child care, and put them to work. They have been doing that over the interim, and so we have here today a bill that has a delete all. And so, Mr. Chair, if someone could move the DE one, and I do have one question. I don't see the there's a one word on the bill that is different than we sent it to the reviser, and so I was hoping someone
Representative Norton, I'll move the well, first let's find out what word you want changed, and Mr. Burris will let us know.
Thank you. On line 3.20 in the DE1 amendment, the language we had sent said may, and this has been turned changed to shall.
I would guess that your office didn't House Research, I believe, is the one that did the amendment, not the reviser. So that's Mr. Burris's office. Is there any problem with doing that?
Mr. Chair, members, the original language does have a shall be provided, but you could incorporate a change to the delete all amendment to replace the word shall with may on page 3, line 20.
I'd like to do that.
Representative Norton, I will make a motion to to move the DE1 amendment with the word may instead of shall on 3.20. Is that okay?
That would be great. Thank
okay.
you.
Okay. All in favor of putting the bill the shape the author wants, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. So what we have before you today is a bill that's been worked on with the department. They have been here and will pop in again to assure you that they're okay with the language. Reggie was in a moment ago. She'll step back in. She thought we were second. Oh, and there's Jerry Kerber, and we've met with him as well. So a couple of the sections in the bill, I'm just going to let you know what the changes are. We have had instances on a corrective action where a corrective action has been filed in daycare providers where there are no children in the home, and the example that I know of is sheets on a crib. When there are no children present in the home, often the providers will wash their sheets and they take them off, and there has been at least one instance where a corrective action was filed while they were, that no child was present, but a visitation occurred at that time and they were offered a corrective action, which you have to post then saying you have violated a rule. And when there isn't a child present, there's no harm done and people have to do laundry. So we've added this some language in there that would keep that from happening, and also show that a safe sleep space is readily available for each infant present in the license holder's care. So that's one part of it. The second part of it has to do with contractors. Often daycare providers will hire a contractor to do music or do some sort of activity for the children, and currently those folks have to be licensed. What we're asking is that the county save that licensure application, keep it, and then they don't have to be, the background checks don't have to be done by every single provider, but the contractor has been checked. Does that make sense? Have I explained that appropriately? Mr. Chair, you look like you might have a question.
Yes, Representative Norton, maybe I'll go ahead with yours. And
the
I'm just trying
study.
To think of of how that relates to some other things that are going on.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, when I'm done, I do have a couple providers here that maybe can give you specific examples. A third change has to do with the sudden unexpected infant death and abusive head training trauma. This is the one that we added the May. Currently, there is a process in law for the trainings to occur, and we're asking for a change so that it can be a single course, no more than 2 hours in length, and that it be a complete it can be completed either face-to-face or in a classroom or online every other year. In the off year, they can watch a video. So we're just making a modification that will make it easier, particularly in rural Minnesota, for folks to get the training that we required them last year to have. So it's just a slight modification to that. And again, with the Section 4 of the bill just says that contract persons only have to have one background study done and that the county will save that. So I just wanted to offer these pretty much common sense solutions to a few minor problems that came after last year's more comprehensive bill, and I think this was pared down from a list of about 11 that we started with, and these are, I think, non-controversial, and hopefully these providers can answer any questions you have about the practicalities.
I have just a question right off. Mm-hmm. Could you explain the one about the contracting with somebody to come in to do what and whether the provider will still be there during that time, or just how that works?
As I understand it, Mr. Chair, that the provider is still in the home.
Okay.
They contract in for a supplemental service that maybe they can't or don't want to provide. For instance, if I had to sing to my children in my care, it would not be a pretty thing, but there are people in my community that contract
I
those services.
Okay,
thank you. And so if it's all right with the chair, Jackie Harrington, one of the providers from Rochester, would like to testify.
Ms. Harrington, go ahead.
Hi, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jackie Harrington, and I am a licensed family child care provider from Rochester and have been in family child care for 15 years. I'm also a volunteer board member for my local child care association, Family Child Care Incorporated of Olmsted County, and am here today on behalf of Family Child Care Incorporated in support of House File 2001. I've had the aid pass out the brochure that describes our association, and so if you want more information about our association, that will give you a little more information. But specifically to the bill, during the past several months, FCCI has worked very closely with Inspector General Kerber and the DHS Family Child Care Licensing staff on the components of the bill, and we are in agreement with its contents, and today we're asking for your support. First, the bill proposes a single transferable background study for independent contractors and family child care programs within a county, such as the music instructor or Zumba instructors, and also our substitute care providers. What currently is required when a music instructor comes to my home is that, and she actually services 25 other family child care homes, is that each of the 25 providers needs to submit a background study for her to the county to be approved to come into their program. I've spoken directly with the region's licensing staff about this, and they note that this is very cost ineffective practice to run a background study 25 times on the same individual, not only for their time but for the cost of the background study. So what we're proposing is that a single background study would be completed and kept on file in the county for any provider that would want to use that particular individual, that contractor, and a simple phone call from the provider to the county licensing staff would let them know, yes, they are approved and they have met the training requirements if they are a subcontractor, and any other additional information that's needed if they're a substitute provider.
I have a question on that. When you say a substitute provider,
mm-hmm.
the substitute provider, I believe your Representative Norton said the provider would still be in the home when the substitute's there?
There are a couple categories of substitute providers, and those are so when a provider hires a substitute to actually go out of the home herself, part of the component of using a substitute provider is to have a background study. And we do have specific providers that provide that service to multiple family child care programs. In current statute, for a substitute to be left alone in the care and care for the children, there are a number of requirements, training requirements, CPR and first aid, the sudden unexplained infant death syndrome and abusive head trauma training. If they are transporting children, they would need the passenger restraint system. With the implementation schedule of the new training hours, they would be required to complete the 16 hours of training. Physical exam on file with the agency. But there's different categories of substitute, whether you're there more than 30 days or up to 30 plus days in a 12-month period, or 31 hours to 30 days in a 12-month period, and 30 hours or less in a 12-month period. And those are current law, and there are requirements for that provider to be alone while the provider is out. Does that make sense?
Okay, go ahead. It's so, not what I was hearing back from a certain department, but go ahead. And I think I'll ask Mr. Kerber a little later. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
All right, sorry. The second piece of the bill is to clarify the safe sleep practice, so a correction order cannot be issued under 245A.1435, which was the safe sleep piece that was passed last year, unless there is evidence that a violation occurred when an infant was present in care. And this affirms that the provider must be able to show that the safe sleep space is readily available for each infant that is in care. This puts in place clarity for licensing units about this statute and a level of protection for family child care providers who during the past years have received a safe sleep violation correction order that includes a $200 fine and posting that correction in a visible and conspicuous location for anyone entering their home when an infant was not present in care. Lastly, the sudden unexpected infant death syndrome and abusive head trauma's annual training requirement will be streamlined into a potential single course on a two-year cycle and made more accessible. The first year of the SUIDS and abusive head trauma training would be completed either in person or online in an online module, and the second year would be through a video. Current statute requires that the SUIDS training is taken in person every year, and then on the off year, the video is available, and the abusive head trauma is required in person every year. The online format is important to address accessibility to training, not only for Greater Minnesota providers, but also to those that are providing substitute care, whether it's your family member or an employee. This also simplifies the tracking of the requirement for the provider, the substitute caregivers, employees, and the licensing unit. That's my testimony. Thank you for hearing me today, and I encourage your support. I just also want to note that we have not only worked with DHS, but with a number of associations, child care associations, and our bill has been endorsed by the State Child Care Association, the Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, Hennepin County Licensed Family Child Care Association, Ramsey County Family Child Care Association, Dodge County Licensed Child Care Association, and just yesterday afternoon, Scott County Child Care Association joined on too. Thank you.
Thank you. And is there a Miranda Oliver? Go ahead, just state your name and then.
Hi, my name is Miranda Oliver, and I'm a licensed family child care provider in Forest Lake, Minnesota. I'm going to scrap what I was going to testify because basically everything that Jackie stated She clearly stated it. I just want to drop some points, I think, that would maybe be a little bit better. The point about having the transferable background study, it would be a cost savings for counties and taxpayers. There's no reason to run 25 background studies on the same person providing the same service. So to me, it's kind of a no-brainer for that particular part of the proposal. The second one on the safe sleep practices, again, kind of the same thing, common sense. No provider should be getting a correction notice from having a blanket that they're storing on the side of a pack and play for a child that's not even present. And that has occurred. The last one, I'm going to give you a personal example for that one, the SUIDS and abusive head trauma training. My parents, a former retired police officer and a retired teacher, are my backups if there's an emergency in my program. And they have to take the SUIDS and abusive head trauma training. They live in Detroit Lakes. I live in Forest Lake. So they're 4 hours away. It's not like I could ask my parents, come to this training with me. It needs to be something that's accessible. And the way that the bill is written now is that it's accessible where they could take that training online. So it would be something that would be more pertinent for providers that don't live in the Seven County Metro to be able to take. So that's the only thing I have. So thank you for letting me come and speak today.
Are there any other testifiers on this bill? I'd like to hear from the department.
And Mr. Speaker, Representative Lane stepped out of the room, but she found a typo on line 3.25 and asked me to correct it. We should cross out, strike the word trainings and training. There's a double, and it should be in-person training. Oh, she is here. I'm sorry, Representative Lane.
Since Representative Lane caught that, do you want to move that?
Yes, I was wondering if you meant not receiving training in person or allowed they would then be able to use video and just cross out these trainings.
He said either would be fine. Okay. So whichever you prefer to move, you can move.
Let's just cross out these trainings on 3.25.
These trainings, so it's not, so it'll read license holders not receiving training in person.
Right.
That will work.
All in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? No. Carries. Okay. Mr. Kerber, does the department approve of this or?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jerry Kerber, and I'm the head of the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Human Services. And yes, we worked with Representative Norton and her constituents on this bill, and it really kind of follows what we did last year. Remember, we had a lot of discussion about child care standards, family child care in particular. And this really kind of clarifies some things that were left a little muddy. I think at one point last year there was an amendment made in the committee that made how we were addressing sudden infant death training a little differently than how we were doing the shaken the head trauma training, right. And the goal had been to make these the same, so they're easier to remember if nothing else, and it made sense to make them the same. In the end, the bill that passed, they were a little different, and this makes them the same, and it's fine. I think some of the other clarifications about whether people ought to be getting, you know, correction orders for having items in cribs that are not being used. I mean, there's some common sense here stuff, I think, as was represented. And however, you know, we made some commitments last year to sort of participating in clarifications wherever they're going to be helpful, because it's a broad system here we have. Throughout all 87 counties, 12,000 providers, and naturally there's going to be some variation that occurs. And so the more clear the requirements can be, the better. And sometimes it looks prescriptive, but there's really value in the clearness.
Got Representative Franzen.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. All right, Mr. Chair. It's your fault. Representative Kerber. Or, I'm sorry.
Now,
we haven't been getting much sleep lately around here. Mr. Kerber, is there a process in place to those providers that have received a correction order for this issue regarding the cribs? Is there an issue or a process in place once hopefully this bill gets passed that the correction orders can be taken away?
Mr. Kerber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Franzen, there is a process in statute that allows for people to challenge a correction order. They can always request a reconsideration. And the way that works is that if the county gives them a correction order and they disagree with it, they can request reconsideration to the department. And then we have somebody take a look at it. And we're trying to look at whether or not it is, in fact, a violation and whether or not it's a violation, essentially, as is enforced statewide. And so there is a process, but, there are timelines for that. And so if there was an intent for this to be sort of retroactive to allow those people who may have received a correction order of this nature but didn't challenge it through the reconsideration process, then there could be a slight amendment here that, as the bill goes forward, I could certainly offer to help with.
Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Franzen.
And to Representative Norton, would you be amendable to something like that?
I certainly would.
Okay, thank you.
I think it would be amenable, not amendable. We're not going to amend Representative Norton. And Representative Norton, before I called on you, I think you said yes, so I assume that's the answer. Are there any other questions on this bill? Okay, then... the chair renews his motion to refer House File 2001 to Health and Human Services Policy. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries about 2-0.
Thank you.
Three. Thank you. Representative Clark. Oh, there. Chair will move House File 2115 be referred to Health and Human Services Finance. Representative Clark, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Present your bill. Is there any... there's no amendment, correct?
There is an amendment, but it didn't get to you in time. I'm going to ask you. I think you have to have it 24 hours, right? So, or do you?
Pardon? We do have a rule. It kind of depends on what it is and if there's an objection.
Mr. Chairman, let me just tell you about the amendment. I don't know. The amendment came from the Department of Human Services. I didn't see it until today. Apparently, they did send it on Monday, but we didn't. My office didn't see it till today, so it didn't get in on time. But I'm fine with it. And we met today and went over all the parts of it. But it's really up to the committee if you can... let us put that on or not. I can explain what the bill does, maybe, and then what the amendment does.
We'll.
Did you get enough? I have a lot of copies.
Representative Clark, does it? Apparently, it changes quite a bit of the bill. It looks like quite a few places.
It's kind of minimal, but it does. It does. I mean, it actually tweaks a lot of things. I'll put it that way. But there's just probably one part that's more major. Maybe should I explain the bill first and then tell you?
Yes, why don't you explain the bill so that everyone has a chance to look at this and try to pay attention to you at the same time. Go ahead.
Is this what I gave you? Oh, this is actually I gave her the first document that came in the mail, but she has the actual official amendment that was drafted upstairs, so it's the same thing, but it applies, it's written in the legislative lingo. So, Mr. Chairman, what the bill does basically is to establish a child care professional development pilot project, and it also repeals a portion of the Minnesota statutes that has been a problem, particularly for some of our new American immigrant families. So let me just explain the first part to you first. The child care professional development pilot program is actually bringing back something that many years ago I worked on, Mr. Chairman, which was to, within our child care system to try to make sure that the people who are working there have a career ladder, an opportunity to get informed, get some education and training that allows them to go up their career ladder within the actual child care center. And one of the changes in the bill that it's mentioned a couple times is to make clear this is applying only to centers. It does not in any way affect family child care. But for some of our child care centers, what we want to do is make sure that there's an opportunity for what I'd almost call, Mr. Chairman, pre-apprenticeship type of learning experience. And we have a model that we did. Actually, I was the author of that many years ago. And it did help individuals learn to start out perhaps maybe as a child care assistant and eventually over a period of time progress with the proper training all the way up to even be teachers. So that's the goal, is to try to make sure that we have professional and culturally competent child care providers. And, Mr. Chairman, this bill was brought to me, as I mentioned, by many of our, by specifically the gentleman and others from the Somali community who were concerned about what the second part of the bill does, which is repeal a portion of the Minnesota law that says that there can be no more than 50% of the children in the child care center who have a relative or parent or someone living with them, one of their extended families working at the center. And that is a real big problem for large immigrant families who tend to have a number of children in child care center. You may have both preschoolers and then after school children, so that you may have, with just a small number of families, you easily reach that 50% mark. So that's what the second part does. So, Mr. Chairman, the amendment before you mostly just tweaks some of the language around the child care professional development, the career ladder, as I'm talking to you about, and it provides some of the language that the Department of Human Services is more comfortable with. And I agreed with that. I don't have any problems with those changes. So if you're willing to have that amendment, that would be...
Representative Clark, I think what we'll do is go ahead with the rest of the testimony. Okay. In the meantime, people can think about the amendment.
Okay. That's fine.
We don't have any names for testifiers, so...
I'll have them introduce themselves, Mr. Chairman. The first, Mr. Hushey, is the president of the New American Business Association. I'm going to let him introduce himself and tell you his...
Which business association?
New American Business Association.
Oh, okay. What's your name?
Mahmoud Hashi, M-O-H-A-M-U-D, Hashi, H-A-S-H-I.
Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to come before you and to testify. I represent the organization New American Business Association, which is an organization that has members of New American Daycare Centers in the Twin City and beyond. We are here to support the bill because the first part of the bill, which is professional development, child care professional development project, pilot project, has the intention and addresses the need for many employees in the daycare centers who are from East African immigrants who are new to the system. Whom most of them, it is the first job that they have in the daycare centers, to give them an opportunity to get training so they can have the career ladder. So when they end some training, they can become teacher aide, teacher assistant, teacher, director in the daycares, and they can go into the mainstream jobs. So we support this bill, which exactly addresses the need for the many of our employees.
Thank you. And the other testifier?
Yeah, my name is Abdirizak Chama, A-B-D-I-R-Z-A-K, Chama, C-A-M-A. And I am one of the board of the trustees of New American Business Association. which and in Minnesota. I come to know this. I want a training this morning and for NAC. It's called National Accreditation Education for Youth. And the information that I get from that 3 hours training really was very, very important and crucial for that child care centers. I come to know that an aide can be a teacher, full teacher, or an assistant teacher could be a lead teacher if takes work course or course education, as well as certain professional in-service trainings through the year. That's what's missing here, and I support this child care professional diploma because it's the one that makes sure that all daycare centers can get or access to these resources, and they build the foundations that our future children needs to do. Thank you.
Okay. Is there any other people who would like to testify in this bill? Ms. Oliver?
Hi. Yes. My name is Miranda Oliver. I just spoke a few minutes ago. I am actually the one of the former past presidents of Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association, the state Family Child Care Association. And I think there was an amendment that was maybe supposed to be proposed today that didn't occur. No, but it would lose family child care. However, there's a program that already exists, which I don't know if members of this committee know that or if you know that. It's called the Hands-On to Teach Learning Program, and it's been successful for many years. It's currently owned by Minnesota Licensed Family Child Care Association. I'm not a representative of MLFCCA currently, so I'm no longer a board member, but so I can't speak on behalf of MLFCCA. However, I worked with the program. We worked with new Americans that were Somali, Russian, Hmong, and Spanish-speaking descents, and were able to make that program work with 200 to 300 providers. And currently, MLFCCA has mentors and coaches that are language trained that could do this program. So it's something I think that the committee should be aware of.
Okay, Representative Meyer has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Clark, could you please define new Americans?
Representative Clark.
Sure. What we mean by that generally in today's parlance is we're talking about people who are new immigrant Americans, new immigrants and refugees who've come to Minnesota. And it's a word that's often preferred by those communities to be called new Americans, maybe rather than just immigrants and refugees.
And then, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, what are you specifically trying to accomplish in this bill through this pilot?
Representative Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I mentioned earlier, and I think it was just elaborated on a bit by the witnesses too, this is kind of a reconstituting of something that happened a number of years ago. I happen to be the author of a bill that created a pilot project that allowed people who start out kind of at the lower rung level in a child care center to get some on-the-job training and some other kinds of training that would be allow them to progress up the career ladder to, you know, from child care assistant to, you know, the next level to the next level to the next level, and eventually, over a period of time, be able to become child care teachers. And the part of the reason for that is, especially with our new Americans who have many different languages and cultural context, it's important that we stay abreast of those needs, and so some of this would be happening right on the job. The previous pilot project was very successful. We just didn't continue the funding with it over the years, and so this kind of reconstitutes that, but it's probably with more updated in terms of our new Minnesotans and new Americans.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, you mentioned funding and that it was discontinued. What is the approximate cost of this bill?
Representative
Mr. Chairman, we don't have a fiscal note on it yet, and it's the kind of thing that it partly depends, of course, on what targets we have for our various committees, and it also depends on, that's partly what it depends on, I guess, more than anything. We're trying to start something that we know is very cost-efficient. It's very cost-effective to have this kind of progression of our workers in many fields up into a more professional level. And so I don't have a number for you today. I'm hoping what we'll do today is begin the process of getting a fiscal note for this. We haven't gotten one yet. Right. And I've been working with the department on a regular basis. I'm sure that we will have a number. We don't have one right now.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to state, this is a pretty substantial amendment here that is dated. The time stamp is 4/11. After a committee has begun, just concerned about my members being able to have a chance to take a look and see what the consequences of this are.
Well, Representative Mayor, I was going to have Mr. Kerber come up and explain what DHS, why they're apparently the one that sent this, and so I thought we'd have explain it and have a lot of chance for questions on anything, and then you can decide whether or not. But rather than decide before, I think we should let him explain exactly what it does, and then we can know whether we really have to lay it over or not. Mr. Kerber, could you explain the whole amendment? And I have a question after that as to what the effect of the repealer is.
Members, I'm going to turn over to Deb Swenson-Klatt from the department, who was more involved in the amendment.
Oh, okay. Ms. Klatt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Deb Swenson-Klatt. I'm with the Department of Human Services Child Development Services Unit. And we did provide technical assistance to Representative Clark on Section 1 of House File 2115. The amendment language you're seeing in front of you would provide some clarity to some provisions of the language. It modifies some of the language so that the terminology aligns with our professional development system efforts in place right now in Minnesota. And we offered this suggestion in the amendment to remove references to family child care providers. You'll note, for example, in line 1.14 and 1.15 of the amendment. And we also recommended striking reference to the rule regarding family child care providers. That is in line 1.12, and the rule number is 9502. Those references we recommended be struck because the bill refers to utilizing the apprenticeship program in Minnesota Statute Chapter 178 as a kind of structure for the pilot project, and this apprenticeship program implemented by the Department of Labor seems to be more of a fit for an employer with employees on staff rather than a family child care business model, which is a small business owner model. So that was our recommendation in the amendment, to strike the references to family child care, so that this would just apply to child care center settings.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions on that? Could you explain what the repealer does?
I would turn that over to other department staff. Jerry.
Mr. Chair, members, again, Jerry Kerber from DHS. I can try. What this repealer does is that it takes out that section you'll see on the one page 1R, and that's the requirement that a child care provider would have no more than 50% of its more than 50% of the kids in care. Is it the parents or 30% of the children? You can't have more than 50% of your employees have children in care. That's it, right? Yeah. So if you have, you've got 100 employees, you can't have more than 50 of those employees who are also have children in care.
On
child care assistance.
Mr. Kerber, this gets at the issue that came up last year, and there was some question on fraud going on, and your department was investigating. So this is going to take out that so that you can have, apparently you then can have all of your children as being children of employees?
Chair, with the repealer, yes, that's what would happen. And we've talked with Representative Clark, and we've also talked about sort of continuing to work on the bill as it moves forward. But that's what it would do, is that there would be no limit on the number of parents who have children in care.
So the department is now saying that what they were telling me they didn't want last year is okay then?
Chair, can I explain something?
Representative Clark.
Okay, so what happened last year was there was a moratorium put on that rule, understanding that many of our new American families have many children. I mentioned this early in my introduction. So it doesn't take very many families. If you have like 4, 5, 6, or 7 kids, even in a child care center, you might have 2 preschoolers, and then you might in the after school program have your children coming in and after school. So that you could have, one family could have maybe 5 of their children in a center. It doesn't take very many families then, large families, to have more than 50% of the kids have a relative, a person who lives in the same building or the same household. It doesn't have to be a parent. It can be. It's quite a broad reach. And when you have families who have come from war and they have refugee status and they may have be living with an auntie or uncle or grandparent or whatever, you can. The problem is that there's a lack of appreciation, maybe, or a lack of consideration for the kinds of extended and large families that we have that are accessing the service. So we have not completely figured out what to do here. We are in a process, and what I'm asking you today and what the department has agreed to do is to keep working on this. We had Senator Hayden, who is the Senate author of this, and I have met with the commissioner and with others over a period of time, and we're trying to figure out what really works. How do we respect the fact that we have large, large families, you know, in the system, and the rule doesn't quite fit for them. And so we're trying to figure out how to tweak it in a way that would really respect some cultural context and at the same time honor the fact that we want to have some limitations. So right now, what I'm hoping is that you'll pass this bill into your committee to be held over for possible inclusion, and that we then can continue to work on this. And we had a meeting even as of today. It's been challenging to find the right time for Senator Hayden and I to get together with all the staff, but we're working on it, and I think we're hopefully making some progress.
It's been suggested to me that if we do a repealer, that it just apply to this pilot. Would that be something that... or does the department want to just go along with the repealer, or...
Mr. Chair, members, Jerry Kerber again. I think that's the kind of conversation we want to continue to have. Is that certainly, you know, this kind of provision was put in the law after a lot of consultation with other states, particularly Wisconsin, and so it's seen to be associated when there are providers who have that many employees who are parents of kids in care. It has been associated with
programs that have been maybe violating the child care assistance program. That's not what we're suggesting in this case. What Representative Clark has been bringing up is that there are some other cultural differences here that should be taken into account. And what we're trying to do is to figure out what's the best way to do that. And if it's tying it in with that apprenticeship program, that seems like one option that kind of makes some sense. And frankly, it's not the solutions haven't matured, Mr. Chair.
Well, okay, I'm getting a lot of concern about the state of this bill right now, and since it only goes to finance, we don't have to rush. I think that I want to get it flushed out as much today with a commitment that you can work it out by, we can take it up on, say, Tuesday at our meeting, and we would like to have it much better worked out by then, because we're really the policy committee on this, so it's not going to go to another policy committee that can sort this out. Like, if it was going to a policy committee, we could say, okay, that makes sense, and then they'll sort it out in the policy committee. It just goes to getting money, and so we really would, I'm getting the impression there's concern about the state of this, and so unless there's a huge objection, I think I would like to lay it over, and with the intent of bringing it up on Tuesday, and with the intent of you guys getting together and working and into a much better state, so that I think there's concern about even understanding, because there's a lot of things different proposed. Mm-hmm. Representative Clark, sorry.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think we're okay with that. I hope we can meet the deadline for that. But I would encourage people then to really look at maybe I can ask our staff upstairs to incorporate the amendment into the language so you can really see what the bill does, because it is a little confusing, I realize, to get that at the last minute. I got it, you know, I just saw it today for the first time. So we can put it together and come back with the bill as it would be if amended, with a delete everything so it's clear. And yes, I think we can certainly get together again. I hope I can get together with Senator Hayden's schedule so that we can do this together and have something for you by Tuesday. We'll make our best effort.
Representative Clark, as you know, getting senators to do anything is like moving a mountain. And I would also like to know, there's some concern about the repealer as to whether that's appropriate overall. Maybe it should be narrower to the pilot. I don't know. Just there seems to be a lot of things going on here that people are saying, oh, yeah, that thing we're considering. Well, we'd like to have a little better than that, since this is the last policy stop. And Representative Clark, we'll definitely bring it up next week. If you can get a little better together on somebody and
We'll do our best.
That's your own senator.
I know. They're very busy over there.
Yes, we're busy too. But thank you. And
thank you.
It sounds like you're working together well, but just have to get together.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So the chair will lay over House File 2115. And it'll probably be, hopefully you'll be together, and so we can bring it up on Tuesday.
Thank you.
Representative Fisher, would somebody like to move Representative Fisher's bill?
Sure.
Okay. Representative Franson moves House File 2754 be re-referred to Judiciary Policy and Finance. What? Representative Fisher, go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to be before you today with this bill. The reason I come forward with this bill on emancipation is because over the last 7 years, I've worked at a homeless youth shelter, North Minneapolis, as Director of Finance and Operations. And we serve youth between the ages of 16 to 21. And one of the things that we've discovered over time, there have been a number of instances where the current laws we have in the book to help protect our youth don't always work very well. And there have been some failures along the lines. We've had youth who have been in the ages of 16 and 17 who've come to us, who've had disabilities, and their parents feel the best way to deal with them is to keep them at home, not allow them to go to school. And so the kids run away and come to our shelter so that they can continue their education. We've had other youth who've come to us who've been in the ages of under 18 who've been trying to flee from the areas of where there's been drugs going on in the household, or been forced into the sexual trade. There's been severe abuse going on. And so what we're dealing with is we're dealing with a lot of kids who the system has not been able to take care of and have fallen through the cracks and don't have much of a family to go back to. And what we found is we've been trying to secure housing for them and get them in a stable situation that our laws work against us. We don't have, in our state right now, for emancipation of youth, it's done by the judicial system versus a statutory system. And so as a result, when we have youth that we're trying to make sure we can get services for, sometimes we're in a situation where they end up going back into a horrific situation back in the home life because the family is saying, we won't allow you to get help. And we find out that there's no clear process for the youth to get to be able to have some kind of process to be independent and try to make decisions so they can improve their lives. Currently, there are 32 states in the union that do allow statutory emancipation. And I feel very strongly it's something that we need because it will help provide consistency across the basis. Right now, that when somebody comes up for judicial things, sometimes it's as a result of a custody hearing, and the parents are trying to figure out what's going to happen in that process. A lot of times it's being done not on the initial behalf of the youth to protect their interests, but more on behalf of the parents. And so what we're trying to do is attack it from a little different way and try to put something that's a little bit more consistent. And one of the things that can happen if we have statutory something in statute that's clearly defined across the basis is, number one, it can help minors avoid the legal complications of not being able to execute contracts on their own, so that they'd be able to secure the help that they need. We've had youth who need mental health at our facilities, but if they're under 18, their parents say, no, you can't have help, you cannot access that mental health component, even though they've got very serious illnesses going on in that area. And we've been in a situation where it ends up failing and they end up crashing out because they're not able to get those supportive services. And that's why I feel it's very important that we take a look at some of these things. Thus, minors in Minnesota who are homeless or in a foster care could easily access services that, if statutory emancipation was available, it'd be easier for them to get the services that they need to be successful going forward. Sometimes, as part of the statutory emancipation, families sometimes get the time and space away sometimes to address the issues that they have that are going on. Another thing statutory emancipation creates is a uniform and consistent process so that we know that whenever youth are coming forward that they're going to be dealt with the same way from place to place instead of one judge deciding one thing in one part of the state because there's no rules to follow versus a judge in another part of the state. Another thing, finally, that it can happen is that it can be come around is where that the focus is on the child and what the child's needs are instead of what the other needs are of my parents, what's going on in the family situation. We do recognize that there are some concerns out when we're addressing this. Some of the concerns are, well, might this provide minors an access to emancipation? Anyone saying, I'm unhappy with the rules at home, let me flee. In the other states that have gone to the good statutory emancipation process, some of the things that we're looking at here, that is not the case. They've been able to find that what they're able to do is focus on those who have truly been in a situation where their family unit has failed, the social service system is really not meeting their needs, and it gives them the tools that they can move forward with. One of the things that can happen is that we're hoping that if we're doing it by statute, that those who have been homeless, that one of the considerations that we're looking at in emancipation is that this would be one of the things that they would consider. What are the capabilities of the youth to be able to meet their needs going forward so that we're not continuing to contribute to the homeless population? And these are some of the things, as we get into the statute, I'll be able to point out some of these areas that this is hit on. Third, sometimes emancipation has been in the past used as a tool by the parents for their own benefit instead of the minor's benefit. And what this does is this puts it on, it's where the minor would be the driving force on it, and that there be some protections put in place as a third-party person coming in and taking a look to make sure that they've got a good outlook so that it's not being done for somebody else's interest instead of the youth's interest. So some of the things that the bill does as we're going forward is that, first of all, in the petition, is that this would be something that would be done initially by the minor themselves. What it does do is it makes sure that it can allow for a full and also a partial emancipation, because we could have the courts decide that we may not need a full emancipation, but a partial to allow some of the things to occur that the youth needs. And that is addressed on page 2 on line 28, is where they're allowed to have that difference in there. Some of the things that are looked at as the court is dealing with this, first of all, that the minor is open to it, that the emancipation will be in the best interest of the child, that the minor has a plan for stable housing that has been approved by the courts, that the minor has completed or is enrolled in school and working on their education areas, and that they can demonstrate to the court an understanding what the impacts of emancipation is going to mean to them. So what we're trying to do is put forward a process that's going to be very thoughtful and provide some of the guidelines that are going to be needed along the way. I know that this is not something that I'm intending to bring to the House floor this year, but this is to start the discussion of what we have out there in the term of the current process and be able to respond to concerns that are out in the community and that this committee may have. I have been working with a group of people out in the community. Some of them are here today. I've been working with Mary Regan, who's here today, from the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies. I've been working with the Child Law Center. I have Lilia Pantelevia here with me, and also from Legal Aid, I have Melinda Hugdahl with me also. And so they're here to help answer questions and provide any more additional information.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Quick question before any more. Did you say this already? The courts have the power on their own to do this?
The courts currently have the power to take and decide on their own what they want to do. And as a result, there's no consistency. And sometimes when somebody asks what the process is, it looks a little different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction.
So, Representative Fisher, the courts can give all of this power to minors, for instance, to contract at age 16 then, despite law to the contrary?
From my understanding, we don't have an emancipation law, but some of this does come up before the courts now.
Introduce
yourself and help.
Put your name on the record.
Lilia Pantelejeva, our Children's Law Center.
Okay, go ahead.
There isn't currently a law in Minnesota or anything that governs emancipation of a child.
Can you speak closer
child.
To the mic?
Here. We do not currently have anything in place that allows the courts to emancipate a child. However, a child may be emancipated if something triggers it, for example, a marriage, or they've lived separately from their parents and have their own residence. But there is nothing in place in Minnesota that governs emancipation.
Okay. Are you the first witness then, or who's?
Probably welcome Mary with me at least.
Who's she?
Mary Regan from the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies.
Ms. Regan, you're not new to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mary Regan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies and also the co-facilitator of Youth Moving Forward, which is a coalition of homeless youth providers. We're actually very interested in this concept and very happy that Representative Fisher has decided to start this discussion and very encouraged about the opportunity this may present for certain children who really are falling through the cracks in Minnesota. They're not being supported in any system really, and yet they're barred from being independent. And so we think this takes a first step and needs some careful look. We don't want unintended consequences for children and families. It's been 10 years since the legislature addressed this issue, so we do think that the discussion is important, and we look forward to working with Representative Fisher on this bill.
Okay. And Ms. Pantelejeva.
I would echo what Mary is saying, is that we believe that this is a collaborative effort of several stakeholders, if you will, coming together and discussing and thinking this through. There are potentially unintended consequences that we need to think about. So we need to think of all groups of children that we're thinking about. The one we're thinking of are children that may have a situation at home where they may choose to get emancipated out of desperation. We would like to see some language somewhere in the statute that would provide for a transition plan, preparation for adulthood, or independent living plan, somewhere to support these kids for independence, and a few more things to think about here as well. So we're ready to discuss and work as a team with Representative Fisher.
Okay, and Ms. Hugdahl, were you going to testify on this?
I'm sorry?
Ms. Hugdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Melinda Hugdahl from Legal Aid. Legal Aid also provides representation to children, many of whom fall into the exact groups that Representative Fisher has spoken about already. So we've been talking to him about this bill, and are also very encouraged and thank him for starting this conversation, which is good. One of the things we've been looking at, too, is how this will need to fit together with other programs, other pieces of the law as children emancipate and for things that we've extended, for example, foster care and coming back in and some of those kind of pieces to make sure that we're building supports, not making a net zero, I guess, on those services. So we're looking at that, and we're also looking at the bill in terms of kind of more the mechanics as well as when these cases actually come before the court. I think many of you are aware that over the years, the ability statewide to have representation for all the parties involved in these cases and the right number of folks has been hard. This isn't created by this bill that exists now, so trying to kind of think on how this would really play out, too, is a piece that we're certainly interested in. So
I have a question I'd like to have answers to. Number one, what is the result of the courts? What are they doing? How often do they do this? What happens? What powers do they give? There's a lot of questions. There's a huge amount of powers in here. Are the courts doing that, or is this all kind of, and how does it work out? And these are just questions that I think we need to have looked up before we really can get into this. And then how it's working wherever it is and what powers do they give them. And I've got a question as to why we don't appoint a guardian or something, and why you do this instead of having a guardian appointed or something, the old way of doing it.
Well, the guardian ad litem, I need to understand your question, I guess. We're talking about the kids that have an issue with their current guardian. These are the kids that are frustrated at home and run.
But
they don't have a home.
Ms. Right, they don't have a home. Eva, I'm never going to get it right.
Yeah,
back when I was practicing family law, we had a number of these cases all of the time, and what would happen would, yes, they would, there'd be something that got them out of the home, but we'd have somebody else appointed as a guardian to give them the legal, that could do all these legal things.
Right. And
why are we abandoning that, or should we be creating a partial guardian or something?
Yeah. We have a very large volume of children in foster care, as you are, I'm sure, aware, and many of them are in foster care state wards, and they live with foster care. So their guardian is the state or the county, essentially. That's pretty much what's happening. So, and they are not independent. They cannot make their own decisions, and they're not necessarily getting all of the services that they need. So, and we don't have answers. We're certainly here to create a discussion, to come together and look at every single group of kids and what would be the benefits and what are some of the alternative solutions. Perhaps it's not emancipation, or perhaps it's partial emancipation.
And one of the things we used to do is look around for some relative that would be
correct
amenable.
That happens, yep. That's right.
But Representative Meyer has some questions too.
Yes, Mr. Chair, could I ask my questions after there's public testimony on this?
Okay, sure. Is there anybody that wants to testify on this? I've seen you around before.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead and state your name. And
my name is John Toom. I'm with Mache's, Minnesota's largest homeschool association, who is based on parental rights. So we saw this come through. Representative Myra asked me to observe, and so we do have some concerns with the direction. If the goal is to take care of children who are in crisis in our need help, we question the need to create a separate emancipation statute. It seems like the way this statute is written and could be used is potentially kids divorcing their parents at age 16. And that does create some concern for us, the way it's drafted. I would say to Representative Fisher, after reading it, I am intrigued by the concept. I think there is some roles that we can create and play. I understand exactly what they're talking about with these children in crisis. My other hat, of course, is working for counties, and I do public safety corrections work. I work with our correctional folks on juvenile issues, so I'm around these issues quite a lot, and I think there is some potential medium ground here, and emancipation could be part of that. A well-drafted statutory emancipation that takes into account the already existing tools we have under 260C and under the social services stuff could very well be a very positive thing for a child who is in crisis. I'd hate to see this being a competition to some of the rights or some of the tools social services has under 260C. I could actually see a child who may be placed by a court with a particular individual as a guardian, who then turns around and say, I don't like that decision, I'm going to go start my own emancipation action when I turn 16, and have two competing judicial processes going on at the same time without recognizing an already well-established 260C effort to try to care for this child through a case management plan. We actually have under 260C a provision that allows a child who is under case management to be emancipated basically by the determination of their case manager based on the situation that they're in, so that child can get services under that. That statute is 260C.328. And so I think some of these tools may exist. It's just a matter of making sure that we update them, making sure that they are responding to some of the present changes in our society, which have been horrendous for a lot of kids who are out on the streets and are vulnerable, and may be vulnerable because their parents are into illegal activities. And so having a fresh look at this and hearing that he is not planning on bringing it to the floor, I hope that he'd be open to talking to some of us advocates who are concerned about parental rights, and I'm gathering he's going to work with the people who are smarter than I am on social services issues, that we may already have some of the tools there that just need to be refreshed and looked at. So I'm thankful that they're taking their time with this and they're going at a good pace, and I hope to work with them and come up with a result that is positive for children who are at risk in Minnesota. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Tuma, I've seen some families that I think divorce that you mentioned is proper, but
you could do that, and the statute may allow for that, and there needs to be room for that. Children should, Mr. Chairman, have that choice at 16, I think, to emancipate. We do have it in our Minnesota law, but it's not a process. Emancipation is not like divorce, where you say, I'm going to start an emancipation proceedings. You just are emancipated because your parents kick you out. And that's basically the way the law works right now, but it's not always the best, and it's not always the smartest, and it's not always the best to deal with kids who are at risk.
Is there anybody else who wants to testify on this? I was going to ask the department, but they gathered together and left. Exactly. I think they knew my next question. Representative Meyer, you had questions.
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, would you please clarify? Earlier you said something about a child being abused. Isn't there statute already that would take a child out of the home if there's abuse, neglect, or, you know, You also mentioned sex trafficking. I mean, these are illegal activities, aren't they?
Representative Fisher.
You know, and you're asking great questions, and that's what I used to think, too, that that we had laws that would work very well. But in reality, in some situation, when it comes to applying them, it doesn't always work very well. And the one case I think of that we had at our facility not long ago is we had a youth who came to us who was 18. They had tried to access some programs to be at an earlier age and had been running away from home repeatedly between the ages of 16 and 17. And the people felt there was something going on, but nothing was being reported. The child just did not want to be there. And kept on fleeing the home. Eventually, when he finally made it to our facility after he turned 18, he was from southwest Minnesota. They brought him up to us. It was quite suicidal by this point. And when our people started working with him to find out what's happening is every time he was returned to the home, his father was basically raping him, beating him, and throwing him in a closet on a regular basis. And that's not unusual sometimes. And these kids are, it's very hard for them to reveal what their stories are. And that doesn't come out until we start working with them on a regular basis, where the kids are able to find an adult that they feel that they can trust, where they build a relationship. And that's some of the things that we see on a daily basis. And then once we've got the relationship, trying to get them to move to the next state. And for someone to turn on their parents like that, the problem is after the abuse they've been through, they still love their parents. They just want to be in a healthy situation and done and away from it. They don't want to, in some ways, they don't want to deal with it because they want to be done with it. In other ways, they don't want to hurt their parents by going through the process. That's the reality of some of the things out there.
Representative Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, so you are saying there are laws that would allow a child to be removed from the home if there is sexual abuse or neglect or whatever physical
right.
abuse that you mentioned.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The question is, yeah.
There are laws out there for child protection, but those laws don't always work well.
All right. Mr. Chair, may I ask?
Representative Myra.
Thank you. Would you, Representative Fisher, would you please clarify what the difference is between full and limited emancipation?
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Myron. There is a list in here of a number of things that the courts can grant in terms of rights. By going through the emancipation, and some states have done that, is instead of saying that they have rights for everything from being able to enter into contracts, being able to determine their own their own care for medicine, for mental health, etc., they may give only limited. They may take some of the provisions that are in there and say that we're only going to give some of the rights, and the other rights are still going to be reserved with the parents or whoever the guardian is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, how does it work under Section 4? How does it work when a minor is emancipated and then the emancipation is revoked?
Representative Fisher.
I mean, it's for financially. I mean, it just sounds very confusing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Myron, it does sound a little confusing. I know that one of the things that I've been referring to has been some work that was done by Dorsey and Whitney back in July of 2010, where they were going through, analyzing, and taking a look at the what our statutes are in emancipation. And one of the things that they'd realized by looking at the statutes from all these other states is that in some rare instances that they had a provision in there for reunification because of something that might have happened to disable the child, where they had become incapacitated in a way and felt that they needed to revoke it. And there may be other instances. I didn't get to every detail that was through here. In other words, I didn't read all the footnotes that they had on here. I just went by the summaries that they had.
Representative Myra. You're done. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher, I like where you're going. And what I like about it is that you're providing some agency to a 16 to 18 year or 16 or 17 year old to make decisions for themselves and advocate for themselves and choose a path that may work best for them, rather than working through a system that is designed for adults to work out their competing interests. The question I have is, how does this statutory competing interests? The question I have is, how does this statutory approach compared to other states? Is it very similar? Are you basing this on best practices or models, or where did your language come from?
Representative Fisher.
Mr. Chair, Representative Winkler. Where the language came from a number of different sources. I took the report that was done by Dorsey Whitney on the emancipation of minors and the analysis of statutory emancipation, where they had listed in here where they compared what some of the states have been doing, what some of the states not been doing, and they had a number of concerns that were raised that if we were going to do it, things that we had to keep in mind. And so what I did is I basically took the points that have been raised in here and working with the partner groups here that I've done so far, brought them to the revisor and said, we need to be doing something different. What can we craft to start addressing the issues that were raised? As you noticed when I was started off, I noticed that there's pluses and the minuses. What we want to make sure is how we can best address the concerns as we're going forward. And that's where a lot of these things that are written here is coming out of this report. Now, do I have everything right? No, I don't. But this is what I appreciate is being able to start the discussion and finding out what do we need to add and how do we need to tweak things going forward. And I very much appreciate the way that you're taking a look at it, as right now it is very much set up as an adult process here and trying to transfer it more to being able, coming from the youth side and addressing their needs is the way we need to look, and it causes us to think a little bit differently. And this is where it's going to take some time to tease all this out, and I appreciate the offer and interest from other groups who would like to get involved as we move forward on this to try to create a better, not only a better set of laws in this area, but eventually one of the goals that may come out of this is finding out how can the system work better for the youth that we're currently working at across the board. We may find that there's some things that can be done and tweaked in the process that may not need a statutory thing and get us more focused on the needs of the youth.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, one set of suggestions I have, based not on just the general concepts but the language of the bill, mm-hmm. is in Section 2, Subdivision 2, Part B, you have six findings that the court must make. They have to make all of them in order to order emancipation, and it seems to me that that might be a little bit over-prescriptive. To say that, for example, they have to be enrolled in high school or pursuing a GED or completed high school may not account for all of the conditions that are relevant to a 16- or 17-year-old in their life. They may be at a point where they're not able to do that. You also have in number six, the custodial parent has not raised an objection. There may be situations when you look at, let's see, it is number two, where the best interests of the child may not be served by the approval of a parent who doesn't fit the definition of domestic abuse but may in some other ways not have the best interests of the child in mind. So I would just suggest that the more discretion that a judge may have in reaching the conclusion that it's in the best interest of the child, the better off your bill might be. Okay. So that would be one specific response to the language that you've proposed here. I like the idea of a guardian ad litem, a third-party investigator, and counsel being appointed. I think that I think the court system is very capable of reaching a good decision based on that level of due diligence into the petition from the child.
Okay. Any further comments? No. Representative Fisher, did you want to comment on that?
I appreciate the advice, and Mr. Chair. And committee, I appreciate the advice that I'm receiving here, and I will definitely take it to heart and figure out how we can craft it so it gives a little bit more freedom there. But we also want to make sure they have some guidelines so they've got something to use as a guide as they're going through, so that we can have some consistency going through.
Thank you. I agree completely with Representative Winkler, including as I view it, it's another step from the old, which always bothered me when I started practicing law. Children were almost still treated as chattels, and so I've always been a huge reactor against that approach. And so I understand where you're coming from. I think there's a lot of concerns with giving them too much. I would really like to know what's happening. And you say the Dorsey report talked about statutory. Mm-hmm. I'm still trying to get at what's happening under the court. On apparently the court has determined that they have authority on their own to do this, from what you're saying, and I'd like to know where they're going with that, and I don't know how they can create some of these rights on their own that you have in here, and, but that's all needs to be looked into. Is there anything else before we, the chair is going to lay this bill over? Nothing else? Okay, then the chair will lay over House File 2754, and with that we are adjourned.